I'm George Morris, 6543 East Alban Road. I am 67 years old. Jennifer, you have asked me about the streetcar lines, what I remember of them. The main line through Monroe was the DUR, Detroit United Railway. It ran through Monroe from Toledo to Detroit, and it carried passengers. It ran right down the middle of Monroe Street in Monroe. The streetcar station was over on North Monroe Street, about a block north of Elm Street, and there's still a streetcar barn back there. It is now used by a beer distributor as a warehouse. The Detroit United Railway was a successful line for many years until it got into the traffic of the city. It was running the city streets and sort of bogged down that way, and then the Depression didn't help things, and it was abandoned in the 30s, I believe. But it carried a lot of passengers, stopped at Erie, Newport, places like that. And it was a way into Detroit that was quick and clean and fast. There were other streetcar lines, some intended, some started. The Steel Castings Building, or the foundry up on the corner of Rossler Street and Front Street, was built as a streetcar barn for a line that was to go to the west, to Dundee and Adrian. The building was built, but the streetcar line never got off. It stopped for some reason. I don't know about that one. There was another one that came out Summit Street in Toledo, and it ran into Luna Pier and part of Toledo Beach. It didn't make it all the way there, but they did take passengers out of Luna Pier back to Toledo. That was the Toledo, Ottawa Beach, and Northern Railway Company. And it was successful probably into the 20s. The Depression hit that also. Another thing about it, the management got killed. The line was to go right straight north out of Luna Pier through Toledo Beach and the back of Bowles Harbor. If you're ever driving through Bowles Harbor, the road in the back there, La Pleasance Road, you'll notice has a much wider shoulder on the west side, and the pole line continues right across, or it did go right across through the marsh. They were going to go across down by the river and so forth, and go right on. Luft has told me that at one time they came here and they were going to go right on through to Wyandotte. And they picked up a couple people here in Monroe and had a very high-powered car, and they were going up to the Wyandotte and Trenton area, and they got in a wreck with the automobile. He claims they were intoxicated, but I don't know this. This is just a tale I pick up. But the spark plugs of the line, let's say, got killed in the crash, and so did the people from Monroe, whoever they may have been. And that sort of ended the expansion of that line, and it was taken up. When you come out of Toledo on Summit Street, on what they call the Erie Cutoff, you're going over the right-of-way of that streetcar line. It went turned off near the Consumers Power and went right down through the middle of Luna Pier. And that's what built up these beach areas, was the streetcar lines at that time. They had no other transportation. So those were the three that I know of in Monroe at the time. The DUR in its last years had some very luxurious cars. They were low. They were connected up with a line called the Cincinnati and Lake Erie. They were low red cars, and they were fast and very comfortable. That's what I remember of it. I remember of them tearing up the tracks and the finish off of it during the Depression. That's all I can say for it.
Okay, do you remember riding them as a boy?
I never rode them.
You never
I
did?
Never rode the cars myself, no. My father used to ride them and go into Detroit frequently. My uncle used to ride them from his home on North Macomb Street, and he'd go into Flint and get cars and drive them back, new cars, but he'd take the streetcar all the way to Flint. And there was a network of them, of course. They went to Port Huron, Flint, and I believe out Grand River to Lansing and so forth. They were clean and economical. The corner of Front and Monroe Street, there was a powerhouse there on the northeast corner, a big powerhouse to generate electricity for them. And then, of course, there was a line going down to the Monroe Piers. And
what can you tell me about the Monroe Piers?
Well, the streetcar line went down there, and it was probably the only way of getting there. And Monroe Piers was a resort area. It had a hotel and bathing beaches and so forth. And this might not be the way it was published in the papers, but everyone says, well, whatever happened to the Monroe Piers? Well, we had paper mills starting here, and we never knew how to control pollution or never thought of it. The jobs were more important. And the river became pretty much contaminated with paper mill sludge, and at the time people didn't want to say that was why, but when this black material started floating down the river, it was sort of the end of Monroe Piers. And of course the depression didn't help that either. There was a huge pavilion there built by the streetcar line, and when the place was abandoned, why, this was hauled over to where the Monroe State Park is now, and it became the Monroe Yacht Club. It was a huge building, and they hauled it on the ice in the wintertime. They skidded it over there, brought it up to the beach, and when the state park came in there, why, they tore it down because it didn't seem to fit into the function of what they were doing. And it was interesting. The Monroe Piers, I am told, well, it was the harbor of Monroe. The river originally came out in La Pleasance Bay toward Bull's Harbor. But in 1900, they cut a canal through, right straight through from the bend in that river down by the Ford plant, right straight through to the lake. And then the Monroe Piers was built out on that. But when they tore up the Monroe Piers, a man from Detroit bought some of the timber and so forth. And a Mr. Lawrence Bragg told me, he was in charge of lumbering for the Floral City and Lazy Boy establishment one time, and he's very much interested in this, but he told me of them taking scows full of timber to Detroit, and among it were 40-inch square walnut timbers, which were probably taken from over where the Greening property is now. But 40-inch timber is pretty big. Mm-hmm. So, but that was the end of the Monroe Piers. There was a port here, and a lot of your immigrants from Germany, France, and so forth came up the Erie Canal and landed in Monroe here, in the port of Monroe, when it was down there.
Okay, what do you remember about the Newton Steel Strike when it was happening?
The Newton Steel Strike happened in the 30s there. The Newton Steel property, now this is an interesting thing. The property was left from the Monroe Piers, and there wasn't much doing down there. The only way you could get down there was by streetcar. And a local realtor wanted to buy this for the Newton Steel. And an old gentleman and his wife, I think they were of French descent, lived there in a house, sort of, that was left from the piers. It was kind of a hunting lodge. They were down there, and they owned that. And this realtor is, I am told, a Mr. Jesse White, tried to buy it from them, and money didn't seem to mean anything. The only way he'd get down there was on a hand car, a little car that you pumped with a handle, a walking beam handle on it, geared to the wheels. And so finally one day he went down there, and he had $5,000 in $1 bills in a big black suitcase. And he didn't say anything. He just walked into the kitchen, this big kitchen that they had, and he opened up the suitcase and started throwing dollar bills around. Well, the old gentleman and his wife, they sat down and cried. They'd never seen so much money. So they sold it for the $5,000. And a couple weeks later, he sold it for $29,000 to Newton Steel. And that was the beginning of it. Newton Steel came in from Newton Falls, Ohio. And a lot of people still here and their descendants came in with it. They were going along pretty good, but they had a strike back, I think it was around 34, something like that. And I remember going down there, and Mayor Nags broke up the picket line. They had volunteers here, and they broke up the picket line, and the CIO was pretty strong, and they were just starting then, and it was a pretty nasty affair. I remember Detroit News coming over there with an airplane called an autogyro, the forerunner to our helicopter of today, flying over at Lowe. But I was there, and around noon or 1 o'clock, why, the volunteers attacked the picket line, and they used tear gas and such things, and drove the pickets out, and it was a very controversial thing.
So you remember that Monroe was in the spotlight during this time?
Yes, like, I remember
everybody
that.
Everybody was waiting to see what was going to happen in Monroe.
Right. The CIO had a big convention at the state park, and they thought they were going to come in and overrun the town and so forth. But you must remember there are two sides to any of these. It was tough territory then. It was they were very bad times. The nurseries and the paper mills were paying a low rate of pay, and it was tough going.
Hey, do you remember what it was like growing up during the Depression? Like, what things were like at home, at your house?
The things I remember of the Depression. One of the things I remember, I had a friend, I lived on La Pleasant Street, and I had a friend on Navarre Street, and his mother wanted him to go to the store, and I was probably 10 years old, something like that then, and he was pulling me in a coaster wagon, and we were going down the Navarre Street, and we were going to go to Plotz's grocery store on Jerome between 3rd and 4th, I believe, and, or was it, no, it was between 2nd and 3rd, but anyhow, we were going down there, and as we're going down the hill on Navarre Street toward 4th Street, he told me, he says, "Mom said the bank's closed today." And that didn't bother me near as much as the bang in the tail I was going to get when that coaster wagon went off of the curb. But I remember that, and I do remember life changed from then on. Things were rough. It was it was an entirely different time. I was young, but everybody did with less, that's all. It was people lost their homes. Anyone who had their property secured made it through there pretty well. But those that were overextended financially were hurt badly.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember this. I remember a Mr. Dansard that had the Dansard Bank. And I was in the first grade, and I stayed home. My aunt, or my father's cousin, lived at Bulls Harbor, and she and my mother talked frequently on the phone. She was a widow. And I remember something was wrong in the morning, and I asked my mother, and she didn't want to talk to me about it, but I could tell the way she conversed. And Mr. Dansard had committed suicide right over here. He had the Dansard Bank, which is now the Monroe State Bank. And he had committed suicide because of things, reversals during the Depression and so forth. And I also remember my father's cousin who lived in the house that Mr. Hiltz has now. And I remember going out to her house during the Depression. Once again, I was just a youngster. Beautiful big stone house on the lake. And I was there in the evening, and they had gasoline lamp there, like a Coleman lantern, only for a house. And I had never seen one before, and I kept pointing at it and asking my mother, "What's that? What's that?" And she'd say, "Be quiet, be quiet." And as we left, we had an old Buick touring car, and as we left, she says, "Now, I didn't want to tell you at the time, but the lady can't pay her light bill anymore, and they've shut off her electricity. That's the only light she has." Mm-hmm. And those were some of the things I remember from it.
All right, do you remember Roosevelt's New Deals and what was going on?
Well, I remember the Roosevelt New Deal coming on, and the Depression sort of set back a little bit because Roosevelt put hope in everyone. He had a new proposition, the WPA, the 3 C's, things like that. He was getting people some kind of work, and he was doing projects with the government funds. Of course, we went off of the gold standard then. The monetary system changed, but it did bring hope to people, and things did come up some. But you might say the Depression really never ended until World War II started. And, of course, that brought everything to a fast pace, and things changed. But the war in Europe itself, before we got into it, even started things going here. I mean, the economy was on an upturn. But sometimes you wonder if we'd ever got out of it had there not been a World War II.
Do you remember his fireside chats?
Yes, I remember his fireside chats. He was a very good speaker, and he put confidence in people, and he could really get his point across. He was a very good speaker, and he did a good job of it. But there was opposition to him, too, you know, thinking he was a liberal and bringing on things that which are very common now, but he was a controversial person too to some people. That's how it was. But I remember the New Deal, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and all of these WPA jobs and so forth. The WPA put the dams in the river in Monroe. John C. Lair was in Congress then. At the time that this was started, the reason it was started, the River Raisin ran down through Monroe, and in the summer it was shallow, and it's over solid rock, and there would be puddles in there. And when I say they had the same kind of sewers, the sanitary and the storm sewers were all in one, and the raw sewage from these various streets would run out into the river. And in the hot summer, it would lay in these pools in the rock, and it would smell, and it was a pretty dirty situation. And Mr. John C. Lair was our congressman here, and he put a WPA project through to put those dams in the river. Well, we put sewers alongside of the river at the same time to take the sanitary, to contain the sanitary sewers, and by filling the river up and having these dams, it aerated the water and created this problem.
Okay. Do you remember somebody named Father Coughlin?
Yes, I remember Father Coughlin being on the radio, and of course there was no TV then, and everyone would gather around to hear him speak. Father Coughlin was also a very controversial person. He racially, he was a bigot in this respect. He condemned the Jews and people like that. He was speaking out of context for the church, I believe. But in some ways, for some groups, extreme rightist groups or whatever it may be, he'd say what they liked to hear. And it was not, as I say, it was not proper, but he got away with it. And I don't know for how long. He got a lot of money. He made the Shrine of the Little Flower up there on Woodward Avenue. It still stands, but he was not in line with the church policy at the time. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'd like to tell you of a company that had no charter, no taxes, or no overhead, really, except for a couple gallons of gas once in a while. During the Depression, it was very hard to buy fuel, do things like that, and we had an establishment going called the Moonlight Coal Company. The cars would come through, the trains would come through from the south, going north, carrying coal. And these people had to keep warm in the east end of Monroe and all over Monroe. And a lot of them didn't have any money. There was no welfare system then or anything. I mean, you just did the best you could. So these people would all get together and they'd get an old car or an old truck and they'd drive out to Erie. And as the coal train left the yards at Erie, they would select cars of lump coal, large lump coal. And that's the way it was shipped then. You don't see much of that anymore. It's all fine. But there were huge lumps up to a half bushel size on there. And they'd get on a car of coal, and they'd build up a wall on the one side of the car of lumps, of big lumps of coal. And all the way in from Erie, as the train was moving north, they'd build up the wall of coal on their car. And when they got into the east end of Monroe, they start pushing coal off. And when you ask somebody what they were doing if they didn't have a job, well, I heave a little coal. They'd get on the trains and do this. And as the train went through Monroe, well, they'd push coal all over the place there, knock it off of these walls that they built. They'd knock off the wall they built on the car. And push carts and wheelbarrows and cars would come out of nowhere and load the coal, and it would disappear. And the men would get off of the train the best way they could, jump off in a field or whatever. But the railroad detectives and the police and so forth tried to stop it, but it didn't quite work out. The Moonlight Coal Company was 75% successful.
What years were these?
This was in the 30s. It was happening in 34, 35, along in there, and still going on, you know, and that was it. And then, of course, bootlegging was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Up until Prohibition was abolished, bootlegging was big on Kentucky Court, which is back off of Kentucky Avenue, just below 5th Street along in there. It ran a little L-shaped street that ran to the west and then to the north. Well, they had Liberty Hall back there, which was a long building, and the biggest battery of stills in Monroe County was found in Liberty Hall. And then around the corner to where the L-shaped street ran to the north was a huge four-apartment house, a big square two-story house. And they found the largest single alcohol still in the area, I think maybe in Michigan in there. And this still had a pipe laying along the cemetery wall, laid in the leaves and so forth. There was a retention wall on the east end of the cemetery there, and they laid a pipe in there over to a garage at a little house on 4th Street. And I remember they had a 1934 Ford panel truck. It was a ton and a half truck, but yet it was like a panel truck. And it had dual wheels on it. And there were two of these, and they would back those in the garage, and they had a tank in them. And they would fill this up with illegal alcohol and drive it out somewhere. So the only outlet they saw was this little house and garage. And the trucks would back in there at night like they were putting them away, and the next morning they'd drive out, one would drive out, and another one would go back in there. And that was hauled out of there that way. And there was a lot of this. There was bootlegging across the lake. There was Canadian liquor coming in because it was legal over there. Whiskey and beer, both. And one of the things they did, they came across the lake on the ice. You didn't have the heat or the pollution, and they had better ice formation. And I remember a neighbor having a Model T pickup and see it coming in the morning, loaded up, and a couple of planks strapped on the side. So if he ran into an opening in the ice, he could get across it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, but most of it was hauled by boat. And the Coast Guard was here to try and stop it and so forth, but it was too big and too vast, and it was a way of making money, so it happened.
Okay, in the last few minutes I have left here to ask you, I want you to tell me what you did for entertainment as a boy in Monroe.
For entertainment?
Yeah, what kind of things would your family do that you remember having a lot of fun doing?
Oh, the things I remember were just playing with other children, games in the street, and when I got a little older, why, I got parts to a bicycle and such things as that, but a lot of times we would just walk. We had no transportation. We'd walk to Bowles Harbor or places like that. It'd take us all day, and we had nothing to eat, and we were pretty hungry when we got home, but it was fun, and it was something to do. And of course, there was the creek, Plum Creek, to play in and catch minnows or pollywogs, whatever it may be. And there was a stone quarry, and we did some pretty dangerous things there. But one of the things was to take the tool car that they had, just a little flat car that had four wheels on it, and we'd push it all the way up the side of the quarry, and then ride down in a very dangerous fashion and go down into the quarry. It was a thrill ride, and we used to swim in the canal down there, things like that. We'd swim in the creek. If we didn't get a swim in by the middle of March down there, why, we just weren't anybody, see. And, it was very icy, very cold. We'd climb up the walls of that quarry in places that terrify me now to think of it, but we did those things.
Did you listen to the radio a lot?
Oh, I listened to the radio in the evening, and in the winter time when we had an old Atwater camp radio, and I remember some of the things that were on it that were interesting to me. The news reports, some of them that came out then, I even remember them now and what they were about, you know. Mm-hmm.
What were some of your favorites?
Well, one of the things I remember, recently a man wrote a book on the fact that we knew the Japanese were going to steal the plans for a heavy cruiser. This was around in 1934 or 33, something like that. And the March of Time, Time magazine put this on, and they would dramatize these things. And this man's book that came out recently tells that the Japanese were going to steal the plans for a heavy cruiser, and the United States found out about it, so they designed a hull for a heavy cruiser, battle cruiser, and they made it so it would tip over. They put the metrocentric center below the center of gravity. This is like putting an elephant on top of the Ferris wheel, you know. And they designed it that way and let them steal the plans. The March of Time described this. They made the heavy cruiser, had the hull. They didn't have the houses on it or any of the superstructure. And they launched it stern first, unlike sideway launchings that we do on the lakes here. They launched it down into the bay there, and it had a couple hundred people on it, on the hull, when it went down the ways. It went down into the bay and it rolled over. And the man that wrote this book claims that the Japanese brought on Pearl Harbor out of vengeance for this. Mm-hmm. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I do remember the launching of this and the dramatization of it on the March of Time on the radio, and how the thing tipped over and all these people were drowned on it. And of course the Oriental ego says we've got to save face or whatever it may be, and they certainly lost face when that thing went down there and rolled over. And whether this is all true or not, I don't know, but there is a book out based on it, and I remember this happening at the time.